Hello, Guitar Smarts listeners. This is an important announcement. Please don't skip ahead. We start this podcast with a special message. Way back in 2021, Guitar Smarts had the pleasure of interviewing the utterly fantastic Matt Long. Matt is a multiple award-winning British blues guitarist and lead singer of the British blues band Catfish and hard rock outfit The Revenant Ones. He joined us for episode number 20 and was a truly gracious guest who spoke about his career, his childhood, guitars, and meeting his hero, Joe Bonamassa. Well, Matt needs your help. Through 2023, Matt has been undergoing treatment for bowel cancer, and his recent prognosis has meant that to extend his life and retain a chance of survival, he needs to seek private treatment outside of the NHS. Matt's family have set up a GoFundMe page that is linked in the Guitar Smarts link tree in the description of this podcast, and we at the Guitar Smarts podcast would like to invite each and every listener to consider donating towards this fund that could well save the life of one of the brightest guitar talents of our generation. Now is the time, folks. Head on over to the link in the description to find the GoFundMe page. Donate what you can. Your donation could save a life. Thank you. Enjoy the podcast. For that, you know, 2 or 3 hours that we're playing, I've got to come down from that, and it takes me some time mentally to kind of come back to the normal Matt Oliver. So if I don't have that drive home that gives me an hour to kind of do that, then I do struggle. I a quick drive home for me after a gig, and I have to sit around in the lounge in the middle of the night having a cup of tea. Greetings, welcome back to the Guitar Smarts podcast. We are back again, and this week we discuss my strange preference for relaxing after a long day gigging. We talk about the careful but accessible method that I took to finally level the frets of my much beloved Epiphone Les Paul that's been screaming out for this work for years, and we also talk about the recent news brought to light by KDH on YouTube about Lee Anderson and his personal involvement in some well-known brands, and the complicated relationship between this information and his retail business at Anderton's Music Store. As always, remember to like and subscribe to this podcast. This way you won't miss the next show. Use the link tree in the description of this show to get to our social media pages too, especially the Guitar Geek Hangout page on Facebook, where you can get to know many other guitar nerds just like Kieran and me. If you have any comments or requests for the show, you can reach out to us through our social media page. Anyway, that's enough from me. Let's get to it. Mate!
We're back!
Hey! It's been so long, hasn't it?
This already feels good. I've already gone to my happy place. Yeah, I'm smiling ear to ear. It's been too long.
Do you know what? It's been a great summer of like so many nice breaks and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we haven't been able to talk for quite a while because of various things going on, but it's been really nice to have like a nice long, you know, and summer, but God, it's so good to get back to talking to you, mate. Are you well? Are you keeping good?
I am well, mate. Thanks for asking. Yeah. Like you said, it's been what, 6-8 weeks now, kids off on school holidays, you know, family holidays to take off work and stuff. It's flown by, but yeah, I mean, I've definitely missed our weekly catch-ups and chats, but yeah, you know, it's that time of year, life gets busy, and obviously we need to manage the family and stuff, but yeah, exactly. I'm really well, mate. Yeah, can't complain. Life is good. Family's good. Had some nice holidays. The sun has finally decided to start shining in England in September, which is bizarre, but hey, I'll take it.
I'll take it too, mate. I mean, it's roasting hot at the moment, but it's nice to actually have a little bit of I mean, this summer's been weird, hasn't it, weather-wise? Yes. Not that we want to talk about the weather, but I'm sure most of our listeners are like, what the hell? Tuned in
why
for the weather
forecast? British people, why do they keep talking about the weather so much? It's a British thing. It's what we do.
Oh, but we've got so much to catch up on. There's so many things. Let's just have a general catch up though. What have you been doing? Right, so it's 6-7 weeks maybe since we last had a conversation. What's new with you, mate? Guitar wise, music wise, just what? Tell me what's been happening.
So gigging really mostly with the band actually, which has been wonderful. I spoke to you last after I'd just done a dep gig for the DLB, hadn't I? And I just had my first in-ear experience.
Right, yeah.
So we chatted about that, So since then, I've been doing a spate of gigs with my regular and very much loved band, The Hot Fuzz. Back standing in front of an amp and turning it up loud and playing to my heart's content. And yeah, man, it's been good fun. It's been really good fun. Got a break this weekend from the gigging. Had one last week. Got another one next weekend. So yeah, from a guitar point of view, that's been the main thing. Listening to a lot of stuff, playing a lot of stuff with the band, integrating some new numbers. So just learning a bunch of new tracks that we're going to try and get into the set list, which is always nice. We've got a rehearsal coming up in October to put some new numbers in, which is good fun. I mean, it's got to the point now where I'm very settled in the band, and carrying all of the guitar work isn't a chore, and we're really nice and tight. Not that we've reached a complacent stage at all, but it feels very comfortable now and not anxiety inducing in any way. If you remember when I first joined this band, I was like, it's a lot to do. It's a lot of new songs and different keys, and it's one guitar, but yeah, so I think it's time to kind of shake things up a bit, get some new songs in there and start pushing my kind of playing a little bit further. And there's some ambitious ones. We want to start doing some Queen medleys and maybe some like kind of disco stuff in there as well. So some things that are just going to push us a little bit further, I think.
Yeah, challenge yourself, you know. That's what it's all about. Do something do something for yourself and then... If you enjoy it and you do it really well, that'll translate to the audience, mate, you know.
Totally. So yeah, still blissfully happy with my rig, annoyingly so. Like, even I'm annoyed with myself now as a guitar podcaster and like gearhead. I literally cannot find a reason to go and buy something different at the moment, which is really annoying me guitar wise. There's lots of stuff that's tempting me, but I'm kind of like keen to not mess with what is a good thing at the moment. And and other than that, schools are back to normal duty, so guitar teachers alike and students all want their guitars like setting up, like nothing over the summer. Everyone was away, and now all of a sudden everyone's like, yeah, need my guitar doing. So there's going to be a flood of those arriving in the next week or so. But that's me, mate. That's me in a nutshell. I'm happy, I'm healthy, and life is good. How about you guys?
Yeah, good, man. I mean, much the same as you. You know, I've been busy. I've done quite a few gigs, actually, quite a few deck gigs over the summer, you know, quite a few wedding gigs that have all gone really well, all with the same band, which is good, really good bunch of guys and girls, and, you know, gigs dotted about around the south, which has been great, and
cool.
Not too far to drive, but far enough, because I don't like a gig that's too local. I don't know if I've ever told you this.
You have, and I've not related to this, because I'm the same, right, I can relate from a work perspective, like, so from a day job perspective, I have always wanted to keep a separate geographical location to my office and my day job, so that drive to and from work is head time, thinking time, listening to music time, and when I'm at home at the weekends, I'm in a totally different place, so I can't even think about the day job. I know people that work really close to my office and they can walk it in 10 minutes. And I'm just like, I could never switch off from work if that was the case. But from a gigging perspective, I can't think of anything nicer than just driving 5 minutes down the road, 10 minutes down the road to a pub. But you have mentioned this before, that you like that distance, right? To do things. Yeah.
I like it. And it's more to do with the drive home than the drive to the gig. If it's a long drive to the gig, it's kind of like, what if there's some bad traffic, something happens on the way, and I miss sound check or something like that? There's a little bit of that, but it's the journey home. It takes me quite some time to wind down mentally and climb down from the energy of a gig, you know.
Yeah.
To have gigs where I'm really close to home, you know, you finish that gig, you pack up and everything, you get everything in the car, you get out, and I sit down and I'm like, right, you know, I feel like I'm at a really high kind of state of energy here.
For sure.
If it was like a 10-minute drive home, I'd get home and I'd still feel like I'm at the gig, you know. Yeah. Whereas if I've got an hour and a half to drive, you know, I stick a podcast on, or I put like a, just like a, something relaxed on, some, whether it's like a playlist of, say, like some, you know, easy listening jazz or something like that. It's got to relax me. I need, and that drive home is then me, like, with cruise control on at about 55 miles an hour on the inside lane of the motorway, trucks passing me by, and I am, I'm winding down. And I love that. It's part of the gig for me to have that relaxed, smooth come down. And I get home and I pull into the drive.
Yeah.
Get in the house, and within about 30 seconds, I'm asleep. I'm in bed.
Okay.
And I'm off. And that drive home for me is like this. It's a meditative thing, because I haven't been, my mind hasn't been at that. Yeah, I like gigging, and I put a lot of energy into it. When I'm gigging there with the wedding bands, part of it is because, I don't really consider myself a professional musician in the same way that the people I'm gigging with do, because generally speaking, the people I'm gigging with, it is their career. They're teaching all week, or they're doing sessions and they're recording, and, you know, I'm not like that. I mean, this is the whole idea of our podcast, right? We're a podcast for people like us, weekend warriors who live a normal life and like going out at the weekend and gigging. That's what I am. So I kind of feel like I've got to step it up at the gigs and try and kind of put the energy in to kind of, you know, be at the same level as those guys. So for that, you know, 2 or 3 hours that we're playing, I've got to come down from that. And it takes me some time mentally to kind of come back to the normal Matt Oliver. So if I don't have that drive home that gives me an hour to kind of do that, then I do struggle. A quick drive home for me after a gig, and I have to sit around in the lounge in the middle of the night having a cup of tea.
That's the bit I look forward to the most. So I can completely relate to that. Yeah. But I'm like, I want to get home as soon as possible so I can get a cup of tea, maybe make a cheeky little sandwich and sit and watch some late night TV crap for at least an hour. It'll be at least an hour.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah, at least an hour. But
I just want to climb into bed when I get home. I mean, I literally want to open the door, kick the shoes off, and off I go. But
So I understand you a bit more. I definitely understand you a bit more in that regard. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see if any of our listeners can also relate to that. Is anybody listening, if you're the same, come and tell us in the Guitar Geek Hangout if you feel like you have to kind of climb down in the same way as I do after a gig, or if it just feels more natural to you, you know, because I genuinely do feel like I'm kind of being somebody a little bit outside of myself when I'm at a wedding gig. You know,
it's a performance. It's a performance. Exactly. Like, aside from your really nice explanation around, you know, wanting to deliver your best playing for the band members that you've got, who are kind of quote unquote pro musicians. I mean, obviously, mate, you can hold your own with the best of them, but as you say, it's not your day job. I think anybody that's playing live music, irrespective of level, it's a performance, right? And so there will be that physiological kick in of adrenaline and endorphins and even the physicality of de-rigging, as much as we all kind of groan and go, right, come on, let's get this done and strip down the PA and get it all loaded up and all of that. It's physiologically like kick starting your kind of body into a different way of being, which is not what you would normally do at that time of day, which is wind down with a nice book and slide into bed and go to sleep. So your body is waking up. So I totally think that feeling of needing an hour or so to come down after a gig is a real thing. Completely think it's a real thing. And at a physiological level, it completely makes sense, right? Your body needs to decompress in that way. I just find it really interesting that your chosen method of doing that is driving. So I'm interested to know what people do to decompress after a gig. Because your preferred one is driving. Mine's to get home as quickly as possible, have a cup of tea and a sandwich and watch some late night infomercial shit on TV. And just question who else is watching this at this time of day apart from musicians.
Very good point. I'm sure lots of people have different ways. I just find, it's a driving at night thing. Driving at night when it's quiet on a motorway, like coming down the A303 or whatever it is, or something like that, or, you know, whatever, wherever it is, you know, I find it very meditative. You know, when it's quiet and it's dark, and And the task in hand is simple. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't have to do much
stay
to
awake.
Do this journey. I just have to stay awake and point the car in the right direction. Okay. And I'll put something on that is like somewhat cerebral. You know what I mean? It's not, I'm not saying, you know, I want to listen to something fancy or anything. It's not, the point is it's something that stimulates my brain in a different way that the music has done all night kind of thing. You know what I mean? It's something that I'm going to enjoy listening to somebody talk. To someone, an interview or something like that, like a podcast or, you know, whatever it is. And I find that turns off the part of my brain that I've been working hard all day because, you know, I might have loaded the car up at 11 in the morning. As I'm loading the car up, I'm thinking, have I got everything I need? Have I got a backup for certain things? You know, have I set up my guitar? And then I'm in the car and I often would have made a playlist for the songs that maybe I'm the least confident about in the set or the songs that I've worked on, and I listen to that playlist as I'm on my way there. So all this time, all this after, you know, and then I get there and we're setting up and we're sound checking, and then we're sat around talking and waiting for the gig, and we might talk about some arrangements and things like that. And then the gig starts, and I feel like I've been at this state of mind the whole day, and then the gig ends. I'm in the car, and all of a sudden I've just got to turn it off because I'm done with it at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what it is for me. It's like a, I don't know, it's like some kind of recalibration that I have to go through. Yeah. And that's what I love. I almost, and the more I talk about it, the more I'm like, I'm so happy I've got a gig tomorrow because I know I've got a drive home that I'll enjoy.
That is amazing to me. I know what you're saying, but I don't know what you mean, because that to me is the singular worst part of the entire experience.
Yeah.
More so than packing down at the end of the night, because at least you're having a bit of banter with the guys and debriefing on songs and audience members and all of that. The singular worst part of gigging experience for me is the bit you love the most.
Yeah.
How interesting. I mean, like, I've got a gig. This is probably like dirty talk to you. This is probably going to make you quite excited. Whereas to me, I'm just filled with dread and like anxiety. But I've got a gig at a very nice, it's a pub. It was a very nice pub. We've gigged it a few times before. But our lead singer for our band is based a good few, not few hundred miles, but a good kind of 100 miles or so, 150 miles or so from where the rest of the band are based, on the South Coast in the UK, right? And he makes that trip most weekends when we're gigging.
Yeah.
Right? So once or twice a year, we return the favour and we go up to his neck of the woods to do a gig, right? Which you'd think on the face of it is no big deal. And it really isn't. We do it gladly because, you know, bless him, he's a lovely guy. And it's nice for him to not have to travel that far, at least once or twice a year. But for the first time, I found myself thinking, I'm gonna need to stop over after this pub gig, right? Which I've never had in my life before. But I'm literally reaching an age now where an hour and a half's drive home at the end of a gig, to me, is reaching the point where it's probably dangerous for me to be on the road at 1, 2 in the morning, that tired on my own. Yeah. And I've never had that feeling in my life before. And I've done gigs like when you and I used to be in Roadrunner, I used to quite frequently do journeys like that on the way back home from gigs, but I'm just finding it just too exhausting. And so, you know, I think most of the band are just going to crash over, after the gig up there. And it's the first time where I'm like, yeah, I think I'm going to as well. Cause I just can't face that drive home at that time of night. Yeah. Whereas you'd be all over that.
I would be. In fact, hate the gig that I've got tomorrow then. Which is in Exeter. So I'll be driving 3 hours tomorrow from about 11 o'clock because the sound check's early in the afternoon. And then the wedding gig in the evening. And then when I finish packing up and on my way, probably about 3:30, 3 hour journey back.
So now I'm worried.
Get in bed about 4 a.m.
Now I'm going to be like, I was going to be texting you, but I can't text you because you'll be driving.
I'll be absolutely fine.
I'm worried for you now. Do you not get sleepy?
No, not really. Not after a gig. Like I said, it takes me time. The threshold. I mean, if it was further down into Devon, like if we were doing Cornwall or something like that, and it would be getting, you know, if we're getting on for like a 4 hour journey I'd probably get myself a hotel. What I've done before is actually get myself a hotel on the way. Right. So sometimes, like, if it's really long, like, you know, a good 3 or 4 hour journey, like longer than I've got tomorrow, I'll get a hotel on the way. And what I've done before is I've travelled down, I've checked in halfway down, and then gone on to the gig, so that I still have that 2 hour drive that I like to the hotel. Yeah. And then sleep at the hotel the next day, do the rest of the journey home.
you can tell we haven't caught up all summer. I think I'm pretty sure we've literally just had a half an hour conversation about like travelling back from a gig. But it's brilliant. It's absolute, mate. I'm going to be worried now. I'm going to be lying in bed going, I hope he's home all right. What time is it?
I hope he's normal. Don't worry.
Text me when you get in so I know you're safe. But yes, to your point, it'll be great to hear from listeners on our Guitar Geek Hangout. We'll pose the question once this episode is released, though. But favorite ways to come down after a gig?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm making a prediction. The drive home is not going to feature in anyone's list apart from yours. The long drive home in the early hours of the night. Yeah. Number of votes,
I'm
one.
I'm a little bit scared about what this one of the answers are going to be as well, if I'm honest. You know.
Yeah, that's true.
Cracking open a bottle of whiskey when they get home and things like that, I'm sure.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
That's what does it for you. Anyway. Sorry to interrupt this conversation. However, if you're a regular listener, then you should definitely come and join us on our Facebook group, The Guitar Geek Hangout. Go and join The Guitar Geek Hangout on Facebook now before you carry on with the podcast. I really want to talk to you about something I finally got around to doing recently, which is, if you remember, months and months back, I bought all the tools needed for doing a fret dress. But I've been putting it off because I've been terrified about it. And I've also been like, well, I've got gigs. I kind of want to put it off until I've got all my gigs done.
Right.
So that then I'm not like ruining a guitar, ruining a guitar when I could really be using it. But I took the plunge the other week, a couple of weeks back. I finally took the plunge and I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get the Les Paul that really needs it because that's my oldest guitar. You know, I've had that guitar for, well, actually, 20 years this month, because it's 20 years this month since I moved down south from up north to study music. You know, I've now 40 years old and it's 20 years since. So it's like I'm now at the point where I've spent the majority of my life down south rather than, you know, my home town from up north, you know, from near Manchester.
Yeah.
So it's a very strange time. But yeah, so I've now had this Les Paul for half my life. And gigged it countless times. You know, it was my main guitar when we were in Roadrunner for quite a long time until I got the Strat around the time I turned 30. So it's very obvious when you looked at the frets that I'd had it for that long and been playing it for that long as well. I mean, especially you could tell if I was to give you that guitar and you had no idea of Roadrunner, you would have looked at the frets and gone, "Oh, so you play a lot of songs in A." You know, it was like. every other song was in A. So everything around like the seventh fret, you know, where you're bending the third string. And but anyway, so I got stuck in. You know, I wrapped the fretboard in tape and got everything taped up and taped up my pickups and stuff to stop anything getting into the pickups. And I took the little plastic screw on thing off the pickup selector and taped that up as well. You know, I didn't want to get any crud anywhere, so I really worked hard to kind of protect it.
Good man.
And then I put it down for ages and was like, I'm not ready to do this. I had to bring myself, you know, one step at a time to doing this fret dress. And then I got my level gauge out, or whatever it's called, the thing that allows me to check that my neck's straight.
Yeah,
that took some time. I'd say I got myself to a point where I was 95% confident the neck was straight enough.
That's pretty much all you need to be. The notched straight edge.
That's it. The straight edge. Notched straight edge.
Yeah, because you don't want to use a normal straight edge because obviously your frets are out of kilter. So you're not trying to reference if those are straight because they're not going to be at this stage of guitar playing fretware. You want to know, is the neck there or thereabouts straight, so that you can then start using that as the reference to then level the frets from. And that's what why you do the notch straight edge. But from experience, the fingerboards are never perfectly uniform and level in across the board. So you're dialing in exactly as you say, like 95% roughly straight. So there's no obvious issues, back bow or
exactly
anything like that.
I was pretty happy where I got it to.
That's it.
And then I kind of took the plunge. I was like, okay, let's do this, you know. And I marked up my frets with the you know, the Sharpie, so that, you know, perfect. I've got the, you know, and the idea, right, we're doing that is so that you can see where you've taken material away.
Right,
and
exactly.
Once you've taken the general, the full face of, you know, material off, that's taken away that pen mark that you've just put on,
you should see
pen mark remaining in the dips that you're leveling beam can't get to. And then, you know, I would reapply the pen over and over again, very carefully, and just go top to bottom as I'm moving across the fretboard and back again, and that's then redo the pen. And I swear, I'm not joking, I probably did this 6 or 7 times, and by that time I was down to having just one little divot in fret 7. Where you would bend the third string for anything in A, you know. And it must have taken another 15 or 16 you know, times of doing up and down, remarking up and down before I got
that
divot out. Before that was gone. Because obviously, you can't just do that single fret, because then that fret's lower than everything else. So if you want to bring all your frets down to the lowest level it needs to be to get rid of all the dips and things, and it took quite a long time, but you know what, I loved it. I found it so, well, again, meditative. It was like I'm thinking about it as I'm doing it, but, you know, I'm trying to maintain my patience, I'm trying to maintain the pressure, and I'm getting into this rhythm, just going up and down and just checking as I'm doing it that I'm, you know, I'm not kind of missing any frets or anything. And it became therapeutic, man. Like,
it is, you know, mate. It properly is. And the fact that it was taking you that many passes to do shows that you're not being overly heavy-handed with it. You're taking off little bits here and there. The fact that your guitar has never been fret-leveled or refretted or anything means there should be plenty of meat in those frets to take that level of leveling or erosion of the fret material. But that's the thing that you're also checking, right, is they'll reach a point where you go, oh, there's still one divot left there on the 7th fret. Now, clearly, you'll have minimized that divot significantly. And then you need to assess and go, well, how much meat is there left overall on all of these frets across the length of the neck? Is it worth me trying to chase this one divot and take all of these frets down to match that? Am I going to have enough decent amount of fret left to then recrown and have a decently playing guitar? Or is that divot so deep that in order to completely erase it, I've got to take so much material off all these frets that it's just taking too much off, and it's going to be very difficult to recrown and redo these frets. But those are the things you'll have been checking
as you're going through. That was definitely
Man. Yeah, and it reaches a point where sometimes you go, do you know what? I'm going to have to live with that little divot there, and it will still be better than it was, especially once you've then buffed and crowned the frets and things, you might be able to completely get away with it. But if you've got plenty of meat still left in the frets, you go, yeah, why not? Let's just keep going for it and get it completely gone. And then sometimes that's the option for then just like a partial refret, like one or two frets that are really heavily divoted or heavily dinged, and you've got everything down to that point. You go, do you know what? Actually, what would be better doing is taking this to a luthier and getting them to just take that fret out, put a new one in, and then level that to the rest of them. But it sounds like, mate, you got it all down.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm pretty much got rid of all the offending divots.
Exactly that. I felt like there was still a little bit left on the fret when I decided to stop, but it was on the edge, and I thought, I'm going to crown that bit away. There's no point in me going any further. Because I thought, I don't have to get rid of the entire divot. What I really need to get rid of is where the divot is in the center of the fret. And then if I'm happy with, I've got rid of enough of it, you know, kind of right on the edge of the fret where I'm going to crown away, then that should disappear anyway. And that was the case. So I was really happy with the point where I chose to kind of stop. And then the next thing that I was worried about was, had I left, like you said, meat, you know, enough meat on the frets. One or two of them, I definitely felt like I've taken a lot off here. I'm going to find it difficult to crown them up. But I was wrong, actually. It was still, it was still fine. Still had plenty enough to get, you know, get it crowned enough. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of our listeners know what that means, but just in case you don't, and Kieran, correct me if I'm wrong. When we're flattening the fret to dress it, obviously you're making this, you're putting this very flat spot on the top, but for you to intonate the fret and the string to intonate properly, then it needs to really have like a very specific point at the center of the fret where the string kind of comes away when you fret it, rather than, you know, because essentially what you're doing when you flatten the fret, you're moving the point at where the string comes off the fret, and that changes the length of the string, so it changes you, it stops your guitar from being able to play in tune properly. So you have to crown the fret by kind of just filing down the kind of edges. I'm not explaining it very well, am I?
You are.
How would you explain it?
You are. No, I think you've explained it really well. I mean, effectively, as you've done with your straight edge, you've flattened all of the top surface of the fret. Now, if you imagine like two surfaces interacting with each other, in this case, it's going to be a string and a fret. If that fret is completely flat, you've got a large surface area of the string, a larger surface area of the string in contact with the entirety of that fret, which is going to make the intonation of the note, as well as the overall feel and bending ability and just general playability, be completely off, right? So what you want to effectively do is minimize the surface area that the string actually comes into contact with the fret. And the simplest way to do that is to turn the top of the fret into effectively a semicircle. Which is the crowning process. So you're taking it from being a flat surface, and by effectively rounding the edges up into the middle of the fret, you create a perfect semicircle, effectively. Yeah. And then that means the string is, if you do it well, the string is only coming into contact with a very small point on the fret, which then intonates the note perfectly as it should, but also makes bending and fretting infinitely easier.
Yeah, perfectly described. That's exactly what I moved on to next. I've got my crowning file that I'd bought. I hadn't bought one of these where it's kind of like the edge of the fret, the edge of the file is kind of like an inverted dome, you know, like that inverted kind of thing that you go over the fret. I got like a triangular, a more traditional one.
Nice.
And I started away doing that. I got to say, within two or three frets time, I felt like I had a good technique for it. I was keeping my eye on it because obviously I'd put the pen back on. I'd drawn on the fret again, and I'm thinking, what I'm looking for now? That I've just covered the fret with a black line completely, and now what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to reduce the width of that black line into like a really narrow line that's dead center of the fret. You know, that maybe like I was thinking. Half a mil wide.
The width of a hair.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the smallest amount you can still see where it's just visible, dead in the middle
of
where that fret lies. So
exactly.
Mate, you've done so well. But I mean, I didn't understand any of this until I went and learned how to do it. And someone taught me and showed me how to do this. The fact that you've self-taught yourself all of this up until this point is phenomenal, right?
Well, I've got to admit, I did an engineering apprenticeship when I left school before I then went on to do music. And the first year of that apprenticeship was things like bench fitting, you know, where we would work on metal work by hand, you know, with files. So I do feel like I have a decent technique for this kind of thing. I've just never worked with that on a guitar or anything like that, but it kind of made sense to me, you know, what I was trying to do. So you're doing that crowning thing. So effectively what you're trying to do, you get that thin black line now on the fret so that you've kind of got this, the fret's now triangular instead of flat with a little flat top. And then once you've got all the frets like that, you're then trying to smooth off any of those corners, which I was doing basically with like various grades of emery paper that I had. Kind of just going up and down with the fretboard, which is a technique I saw Ben Crowe do online.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Where you wrap the emery paper around your finger.
Yes, exactly that.
And then kind of, rather than going with the length of the fret up and down it, you're now going up and down the neck from nuts to bridge.
Exactly.
So the action of your rounded finger over with this rounded sandpaper then going in and out of the fret as you're doing that effectively rounds over that triangle that you've created.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a really simple, nice technique.
So I did that, and then I went on to, and I think this is where I kind of, this is probably where I made the mistake that I've made with this, which is I didn't spend enough time in the polishing side of things. I don't think I went through enough grades of emery paper and paid enough attention. And then what I did is I got my Music Nomad, what's it called? Frine fret polishing.
Yeah.
So it's just like a metal polish, you know, and I used that and I've got everything up to a really good shine.
Mm.
But what I noticed after I then did my setup and put some strings on and lemon oiled everything and cleaned everything up properly is, well, first of all, the first thing I noticed is, I can get the action on that guitar down like to half what I was happy with. It plays unbelievably now in terms of action. I'm so happy with it. But when I'm bending, there's still a bit of scratchiness. And I had a close look and I'm like, I've not polished out every scratch yet. Because you're kind of replacing scratches with scratches, aren't you?
Correct.
Is that kind of what you're doing? When you're polishing metal shine, using one grade of emery paper to kind of get rid of certain scratches, then you get rid of those scratches until it's basically smooth as anything. And I haven't done that perfectly. But the next time I change strings, I'll probably just wrap it up.
And
do it again, because it's still playing pretty well.
Yeah, that's the final kind of, I mean, you've really nailed this, mate. I'm so pleased for you, the way you've done it, but also understood what you're doing in a consciously competent way, which is brilliant. It's that last 10% now that's going to make the difference. And you'll do that the next time you change the strings on it. And the now you've done the emery stuff, I think that's probably the phase that's done, unless there's any really obvious scratching that or tooling marks that you can see, which you probably haven't got at this stage anyway. The fret erasers that we've talked about before, again, are really good to get that tip down to a nice level. That Music Nomad stuff, I really actually quite like. I used to use the metal polish wadding that you can get. I think I've still got some. This stuff. Silver.
Okay, yes. So is it kind of like, it's almost like a super fine white, is it like a wire wool, is it? Or
it's kind of like a fiberglass type product, right? Okay, yeah, almost like a wool type fiberglassy product, which has got some sort of mild abrasive component to it, plus it's coupled with a kind of metal polish within it. I used to use that a lot, but it stinks. It doesn't smell particularly, I mean, it smells very strongly of like metal polish cleaner. It's a bit grubby to use, but it does really work. But since using the fret erasers and that Music Nomad, we're not sponsored by anyone, by the way. So this is, we'll get onto that topic maybe in a little bit, but we're not affiliated with, I don't own anything to do with Music Nomad. But that stuff, that we did get some free samples from Music Nomad and HTC a little while back, it's really good, I must say. It does the same job as that wadding stuff. If you just put it onto a bit of tissue and polish it up, it works really well. And then my surefire way is I've got a little mini Dremel with a polishing wheel.
Yeah.
And I put some of that Music Nomad fret polish onto the fret, dab it on a little bit onto each fret, and then use my mini Dremel with the polishing wheel. Oh, they come up like jewelry, mate.
I think
like
that's what I need to do. Jewelry. I think I need to get myself a Dremel. And I know you said I can borrow it, but I'm not in.
You can.
I have to own tools.
Good man.
I don't want to borrow a tool. I want to buy the tool and use the tool.
Yeah, man. I think I got mine from, does Maplin still exist in the UK?
Not anymore, right?
So that's how old mine is now, but available from all good hardware stores, and it wasn't expensive, and it came in a kit, and it's got like little mini drills in there, little mini sanding stuff for your other kind of projects. And but the thing that it gets used the most for is fret polishing, and it just brings them up.
Yeah.
Absolutely, like mirrors, like little shiny mirrors, and then you go, oh, that's that's the last difference. The only thing I would say as a cautionary word of advice is if you've got any guitars which have got the plastic bound fret nibs over them, like you get on some Gibsons and stuff, just be super careful using that polishing wheel at high speed, because it does generate some heat and you can melt, stroke, kind of take off some of that plastic nib if you're doing this. But to be honest, if you've been doing a fret level and stuff, you've probably taken that off anyway.
Yeah.
And and also just watch out for any of the kind of binding on the neck. Make sure you don't come off of those frets. Just use it very carefully so that you don't end up slipping onto the binding of the neck. Fine if it's a piece of rosewood or something, it will, it will hit that and there'll be no issue. But any plastic binding that that polishing wheel comes into contact with metal polish, you are likely to damage it a little bit. So just be careful. That's the only word of caution. Other than that, oh, and don't leave it resting on any one particular fret for too long, because you could unseat the fret, because it does generate heat, right? So you don't want to you don't want to melt the glue that's holding in that fret and then cause the fret to lift and pop out. So just use it at a medium speed. You don't need to go blazingly fast on it. Don't apply too much pressure such that it's actually generating more heat than it's actually doing polishing. So just use a very light touch with that mini Dremel. Be careful not to have it slip over the edge, and don't spend any too long per fret.
Just a few seconds per fret.
Move
from fret to fret. If you need to come back to it, come back to
that's it. That's it. Let it cool down so you don't... But do that carefully and patiently, and you're laughing, mate. You'll get a fret job to be truly, truly proud of.
The other two things I forgot to mention that I did do is, obviously, I then wanted to just do the rounding off of the edge, the fret ends.
I
didn't know. I was kind of trying. I was trying it, and I was thinking, okay, I can see where I've made an improvement here. But I found it was actually I had very little to do. The fret ends were still more or less okay. There was a couple that I did do, but it was very little work. I mean, literally, just for each fret end, just a little kind of round the corner kind of thing, just to take any points off. And then I went up and down the fretboards after I'd done like very little work. I just put my hands up and down the neck and thought, I'm really happy with that. There's nothing catching my fingers, nothing sharp. I'm going to trust myself on that one and just kind of, you know, move on. And then I got the, once I was at the point where I polished everything, I got my little fret rocker out where I could just go over groups of threes and twos and four frets and just see if I had any high spots. And I couldn't find anything. I was at that point, perfect. I was like, okay, I'm going to restring myself. See where we are. And I'm chuffed to bits with what I've managed to do. I'm just going to give the frets a better polish the next time I change strings.
That's it, mate. You've nailed it. You've absolutely nailed it. You've done incredibly well to do that unaided with a bit of reading and a bit of, as you say, your engineering background gives you that natural aptitude anyway to be a bit handy with some tools and stuff. But it's still a daunting prospect the first time you do it. It should always be a bit of a daunting prospect because you're doing something invasive that's taking material away from the guitar. So you've got to concentrate and do it right. But the next time you do it, you'll be like, okay, I've got this. Be careful. Still follow all those natural steps that you did. Don't get complacent, which you never would. And every time it will just get easier and better. And then you'll go, oh, I've got this. Yeah. There is a technique that you can use. And I use a combination depending on which guitar it is and what kind of size the frets are and stuff. But I've got those Stumac kind of convex fret files for doing the crowning. But my preferred file is one that you mentioned, which is the kind of three-sided kind of fret file, which has got safe edges on it as well for making sure that you don't scratch up the fingerboard and stuff. But there is a technique that you can do with those which still allows you to kind of take off the sides of the fret to get that crowning. But as you do it, and you'll get a feel for this, it's a really difficult thing to describe, but it's the way that you go in with the file and out with the file that allows you to round the fret ends while you're doing it as well, but still crown the main body of the fret. And it's almost getting your eye in above it and coming in like you're imagining you are rounding that bottom part of the fret, going straight to crown the side of it. And then as you come out, you're almost rounding over on the other side, but just fractionally, so that you're not you know, coming in at the wrong angle to make sure the main meat of your fret is dead straight and parallel. But there's a little kind of almost
it's an odd technique, isn't it? It's actually the first fret I was doing, I was like, nothing's happening, and then I realized, I'm like, I'm thinking here that the fret is, just because I've leveled the fret doesn't mean the fret is flat. I'm not taking into account like the radius of the fretboard here. And you have to kind of move the file to kind of follow the radius of the fretboard. So you are kind of naturally doing this kind of turning thing as you're going along the fret. And I'm like, okay. So I'm now getting like a fairly equal chunk coming off the fret as I'm crowning, but I'm not doing a straight move. And once I got into that rhythm of being able to kind of follow the radius of the thing, it got so satisfying.
You've totally got it. You know exactly the fit. How amazing. You've felt that out for yourself. That took me a long while to get. And then once you get that technique, all of a sudden it just starts, the file starts to cut better. That line starts to form more quickly and you go, okay.
I definitely benefited from having, you know, my like traditional engineering background and training that I've had, you know, but it's still, you know, it was still, until I got the strings on and was playing it, I was kind of like, I don't know if I've done the right thing. I was like, okay, it's playing fine. I haven't got any notes buzzing out. And the only thing is just that kind of scratchiness a little bit when I'm bending in certain areas, which I thought, well, I'll just polish that out. Time. But there we go.
That's it. Easy fix. Well done, mate. Well done. Fantastic. Shall we do some guitar news?
Do some guitar news. Absolutely.
What's been in the guitar news? I've got a couple of things. There's the main one that you flagged to me this week. The main one
that we will talk about, you know, was big news over the last few weeks. But one of the things I wanted to talk about, I've only just realised, is that the Rolling Stones have got a new single out. I mean,
I just saw that this morning. Just this morning, I saw that. Yeah.
I just saw it as well just this morning because I was looking at news for us to talk about and I was like, what? Those guys, I thought the last tour they were doing was like the retirement tour. I thought, you know, but then here they are again with more music and these guys they're all 80 now. They're getting, you know, they're getting on and I thought, I'm just going to go on Spotify and have a listen to it. And
have you heard? I haven't listened to it yet. What did you think?
I thought, well, it's classic Rolling Stones. I mean, if you'd have played that for me and not told me who it was, obviously I would have said, well, this is quite obviously Rolling Stones. It's right in the wheelhouse. You know, fair play to them. I mean, they pretty much have their own sound still, you know, going on for 60 years since, you know, they first started making music. Fair play to them, you know. What do you think?
I think, I'm surprised that they're all still alive. And I mean that with no disrespect. But I mean, honestly, you know, you read Keith Richards' autobiography and stuff and you go, those guys have just like hit it hard for a long time. And I know they're slightly cleaner and slightly better living these days, but it just staggers me that these guys are still going like this. But fair play to them, right? I mean, I'm watching an interesting documentary on Netflix at the moment around things that enable people to live longer, right? What is the secret to living longer and all of that? Yeah. And it's the obvious things like diet, exercise, blah, blah, blah. Of course, we all know that. But it's this sense of purpose as well and this sense of community. And it got me, and there's loads of examples in this program about, you know, different areas of the world where you get these people that live disproportionately longer. And of course, it's because they're living cleaner, they're living healthier. But it's also because they've got this sense of purpose and this sense of community that keeps them engaged mentally as well as like physically looking after themselves. Yeah. And it made me think about like these older musicians that are constantly still touring and doing stuff and on the road. Now, of course, it takes a toll on your body and it's exhausting and the traveling and all of that. But it's probably when these types of characters stop doing what they love and what they have been doing that things will start to unravel. So
I think you're right.
Fair play to them for keep pushing this. I haven't heard the track yet, but I'm going to do that after this podcast. And if it's classic Stones, then then amen, because there's nothing wrong with a bit of Keith Richards' guitar playing at all on a great Stones track. And yeah, man, why not, while they can, keep pushing.
Absolutely, it is classic rock. It's like if it. Well, this is a very modern thing to say. It's like if you asked AI to write you a Rolling Stones song, it kind of, right. That's probably what it sounds like.
Ooh, do you know what controversy. I mean? Has it been written
classic,
by AI?
The first thing is it really then? Is those classic, you know, oh, maybe it's a good point, yeah. Maybe it is AI. Maybe ChatGPT has just spat out a, you know. No,
are they actually alive? Are we living in a simulation? Who knows? Well, maybe the Rolling Stones, you know?
I don't think now's the time for us to open that door.
Okay. No, that's a huge can of worms. That's a whole topic for another debate. We should do that, though. What is the future of the music industry now with the advent of AI?
We definitely should. We did do a podcast a while back about modern versus vintage, and we were talking about innovations and things like that. We should open that one again for sure, because... There's definitely some more interesting things coming, I think, in our industry, mate. You know.
We're on the edge. Will there be an industry? Who knows? Just type into whatever Spotify will be in 2050. You just type in your own musings of what a song. I would like a song that sounds like Freddie Mercury singing a Rolling Stones song with a reggae feel. And Spotify will write it for you instantly.
Are you trying to torture someone, Kieran? What's the purpose of that?
I don't know. It's an insight into my mind at the moment. No, I'm doing lots of AI stuff with work at the moment.
Oh,
as
really?
Well. Yeah. Well, dabbling in bits and pieces, just touching at the edges of it, but also then reading up about where AI is now and where it's going, and it's mind blowing. It's amazing. Anyway, that's another thing. What else has happened in the guitar world before I go off on a tangent?
I mentioned this on the Guitar Geek Hangout recently, and I kind of feel like I've been on my own journey with this, right? Because we talked about Lee Anderton before, and Anderton's on the podcast. So KDH is the YouTube channel, right? This guy who I've never really watched him anyway. But he's kind of exposed various people before in kind of the guitar industry or whatever it is, you know. He's kind of said some things about Rob Chapman in the past and various
that
other
was
people.
The big one. That was the big one,
wasn't it? I think I don't really know what happened with that. I'm not really interested. I'm not really a fan of Rob Chapman either way. You know, you know, not in a negative way, just in an indifferent way, you know. Not my kind of guitarist, and I don't really listen to his kind of music, so I've just never really taken an interest. It's not really a dislike. But the Andertons thing, he's obviously done his research and talked about Lee Anderton and found out that, you know, he's got these personal interests in various companies, many of which were known. And I think there's always been a bit of a question pointed about how much disclosure he's actually given about his interest in these things. And absolutely, why wouldn't you have? I mean, I think it'd be strange for somebody to be in the music industry, retail industry like he has, and not have an interest in various brands and things like that.
Of course.
Personally, why wouldn't you? That's absolutely fine.
It's not that big an industry in terms of major players. And I would argue, I was talking to somebody the other day that actually lives in Guildford and needed to go and buy a guitar for his kid as their first guitar. And he was like, yeah, I'm off to Anderton's. I've never been to a guitar shop before, blah, blah, blah. And he went and he said, is Anderton's, is it a good store? Is it a big store? You know, am I going to find what I'm looking for there? And I found myself kind of going to him, Anderton's is probably one of the, if not the world's best known music store, I think.
Yeah, it's up there with Guitar Center and Sweetwater and all that, for sure.
It kind of is. Ex-US particularly, it's probably the most well known. And in terms of online YouTube content, I think it's, so they're a big player. And and when you put it like that, of course, that industry is going to be speaking to each other and brokering deals and trade agreements and all of that. But that's not the point of the debate that's arisen this last week, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, it was what KDH was saying was kind of along the same lines, right? Which was no issues with the things that he has a personal interest in as a director or owner or someone who stands to make a personal you know, gain from the sale of some things. I mean, obviously, he's Lee Anderton. His family have, you know, owned the Andertons business. He stands to benefit from the sale of things through the Andertons business, but it's the additional thing of, I also stand to gain even further than that from the sale of some things that, you know, I'm a brand owner of, or, you know, a director, like Chapman Guitars. You know, he's a director of Chapman Guitars, you know. So it's not just that they sell, he could make money from that by selling them through his retail. It's that the Chapman Guitars business itself would also, you know, so he should disclose that, and he has disclosed that before. He should be saying, you know, I mean, he's a director, so. And a lot of people have said, you know, it doesn't matter to me whether he owns these things. What's the point? The point is that you should just be made aware of it so that you could understand if there's a bias there when he's talking about products, or, you know what I mean? Like, if every other thing he does on his YouTube channel is with a brand that he owns, then you can go, well, you know, I feel informed that maybe there's some bias there, or whatever. The point is, people should be made aware so that they can make their own decision. And that wasn't always the case. But I wasn't aware about the Victory Amps thing. And that's the thing that KDH exposed, which is that Victory Amps is actually owned by kind of like a conglomerate of people. Lee Anderton is included in that. He, you know, would earn a dividend on the profits in that business. But he very, very clearly has never disclosed any interest in that. He's never even referred to it as a business that he's involved in. And that was the thing he exposed. And I thought, well, that really kind of, that would damage the trust for a lot of people. But the big thing for me was, and just kind of skipping forward a little bit, I thought Lee Anderton's response to it was fantastic. He made it very clear that, he was all open all the time to the discussions. You know, he was never really defensive. I think he acknowledged where he'd gone wrong. And actually, I think since then, the, you know, Advertising Standards Agency has told Andertons they need to change how they do things online to give the proper disclosure. So, you know, action has been taken. But one of the things that was very clear to me after listening to Lee Anderton's response when he explained certain things is that there's way more I don't understand about how retail and those things work than what I do understand. I actually feel that I was wrong to probably judge him the way I did, because there's you know, I don't think there's any, what I'm saying is I think he made it clear that there was nothing kind of nefarious or, you know, underhand in what he was doing. It was probably a little bit naive and he had his reasons for it. But it made me think that, you know, maybe I shouldn't worry so much about mistrusting Andertons as a supplier. It's more a case of, you know, like I just didn't understand. But it was an interesting thing that, you know, that kind of happened, you know, but quite a bit of controversy. I think Lee Anderton probably learned from Rob Chapman in how to handle it, don't you think? Because I think Chapman one blew up, didn't he? Because he got super defensive about something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was all to do with KDH, who did a sort of mini expose on Chapman Guitars in terms of things like quality control, but also some of the licensing and partnership stuff that they've been doing with some American guitar shops, and Riff City was one, and then I think Guitar Center was another, and kind of exposing some of the ways in which Chapman Guitars had not kind of conducted themselves perhaps in the best way with some of their suppliers and partners and stuff like that, and kind of exposed it. I think KDH was probably a relatively unknown YouTuber at that point. The problem is what happened off the back of that is at the time, Rob Chapman was a huge, huge YouTuber. This is going back a few years when there wasn't the volume of kind of YouTuber guitarist kind of channels that there is now. Rob Chapman was one of the bigger ones, you know, a few years ago, right? And so had a huge following. And this is the interesting thing about the world we live in now today. So as soon as KDH posted that thing about Rob Chapman and Chapman Guitars, factually accurate or not, I'm not here to cast judgment either way on it. You make your own decisions as to the investigative journalism there. But Rob Chapman's following went bananas and set out to kind of threaten KDH very, very kind of in a very bad way, cyberbullying for all intents and purposes, right? To forcing him to take down this video. And it could have then ended there. Maybe it shouldn't have ended there because it's, you know, David versus Goliath kind of situation. But then to add further fuel to that fire, Rob Chapman then went on a couple of different YouTube tirades, effectively condoning the actions of his followers and, you know, further condemning KDH. And it all got a bit nasty. But basically, for the majority of viewers, it actually ended up putting Rob Chapman into a pretty bad light. He didn't come off well from it. And people were able to look at it, his behavior, his language, the tone of what he was saying. People were implying that he was clearly lying and covering stuff up and not being very, not acting with integrity, basically. And so off the back of that, he lost a bunch of subscribers. Yeah. His reputation really didn't do well at all from the way he'd conducted himself. So taking aside the facts of the actual issues that were originally debated, it was his conduct and how he'd behaved that was almost like a public, you know, suicide for him, really, in metaphorical, not actual, obviously. And they're best mates, Lee Anderson and Chapman. Yeah. So clearly, if Lee Anderson's getting an email from KDH going, by the way, I am aware of this, he's going to think very, very carefully about what he says and how he does it, which is what he's been forced to do. It always strikes me as a bit odd, and some of the reasons. I genuinely think it was probably one of those things where with brands like East Coast, which, you know, you can't walk into the foyer of Anderton's without being bombarded by those guitars, which are clearly an Anderton's own brand. Mm. But he kind of declares that, has declared it.
Yeah.
You know, Burns Guitars, he's heavily involved in. Chapman, obviously, he's a kind of founding partner or partner of that company with Rob. Landlord Effects, I hadn't realised. Again, you know, that's got Lee Anderson all over it. And brilliant. He's a savvy businessman, keeping up with modern times and growing a brand and doing really well.
Yeah.
I think it was probably a case of he isn't as heavily involved as all that with Victory, and so didn't feel the need to declare it in a way that certainly the advertising standards people have said, no, you do need to. And KDH called him out and said, no, you do need to. And so why he chose not to, I think is a mistake on his part. But as you say, the way he's then conducted himself, I think is open now, transparent, and he's kind of fully accepted kind of his actions and what he needs to do and done it in a nice way. So therefore avoiding the situation that Rob Chapman got himself into, which was to basically just destroy his reputation publicly by acting out of turn. But it kind of made me think a little bit, and Lee Anderson said this already on his response video. He's like, and I was quite surprised he said this, but again, testament to his honesty, he took the time to remind people that what he runs is a commercial business that's there to make money and sell products.
Exactly.
So effectively saying, my YouTube channel is there to sell products and make my company money, and I make no bones about it. So almost putting a disclaimer over everything that they do on that YouTube channel to say, I'm here to sell you stuff. Right, I'm not just doing this out of the goodness of my heart or just to make interesting content. If you find it interesting, great. I like doing it, and it is interesting, hopefully, to people that are into guitars. Yeah. But it's a channel that's there to drive revenues for my company, and don't ever get confused that it's not that. Which I thought was, well, obviously very brutally honest, but to the point of that is what he's there to do. So. If people are offended by the fact that the stuff that is on his channel isn't as impartial as it appears to be, let's not forget he's there to make money and sell products. I mean,
yeah, naive of us to think otherwise, isn't it? You know,
completely, and then also to the point of yes, he as advertising standards have determined he should have declared his interest in Victory whilst showcasing those amps and things. But where does that line then stop? Really, in terms of conflict of interest, right? How many times has Paul Reed Smith been on that channel, like with him doing demos of PRS guitars?
Yeah, exactly.
Does that relationship then end there? Does he never see Paul Reed Smith or chat to him afterwards? Yeah, or do they go out for dinner and have a drink and have a chat and talk at trade shows and spend some time socially?
Yeah.
And same when him and Pete, you know, fly out to Gibson headquarters and go and try out Gibsons and order like, 100 different Gibsons for Andertons. Are you telling me that they don't all go out for a drink and like have some dinner together and all of that, or go and see an NBA basketball game or whatever? I'm not stating facts, and I'm not trying to be incendiary with my words. I don't know any of that stuff happens, but I'm just saying, people, be realistic about the world that we work in.
Yeah, these
people are there making business deals, making money. It's a commercial enterprise. of course there's going to be conflict of interest across the board, right? Because that's life. That's, you know, should he declare every time he's met with anybody else that, you know, is linked to his business? And anyway, storm in a teacup stuff, but fair play to him for the way he's handled himself though and been open.
Yeah, that's, I think that's what I really liked about it. It's kind of like, he came out with this response exactly as you say, reminding people, hey, you know, it is a retail business, don't forget. And I was like, and I literally listened to him and went, of course. It's not a service industry. It's not like, you know, commerce has broken out somehow. Yeah. That's the thing, you know, when he explained in his response that, you know, some of these brands that they have, like the landlord effects and stuff, the reason why, you know, it may seem like there's information held back, he said, it's because a number of different suppliers, you know, retailers got together to form a buying group, which is where you pool your money so that you have more buying power with manufacturers to create something that you want to sell. And that means that they can get the prices lower and it means they can get bigger distribution. And he explained it and I just thought, well, that's absolutely totally logical. Do you know what I mean? That makes complete sense. It's even I know that, you know, because, you know, the industry I work in, we work with customers who, you know, you get better, you give them better pricing the more they buy. So what is illogical about that? And like I said, I listened to his response and I thought, you know, I've made a judgment here off too little information. You know, do you know what I mean? It's kind of like out of ignorance, really. You know, I've made a judgment out of ignorance and I thought, well, you know, I should give him the benefit of the doubt. Plus, also, he doesn't owe me anything. You know, I've spent enough money in Anderton's to know that, you know, I'm perfectly, you know, in control of the choices I make. I don't have to point the finger at other people too much. But, big bit of news, wasn't it, that? Big bit of news. It was interesting to see how it kind of unfolded. It was good that I thought Lee Anderton's response and the way that he kept his responses to KDH professional, I think it helped keep kind of the, you know, the lid on the, you know, the chip pan kind
of thing. Very smart. Very, very smart. Very smart
businessman. He hasn't got to where he is being a very successful businessman by making silly, rash, emotional decisions. So
no, exactly. And I think it's more an interesting observation on how we as consumers and audience now need to think about and still use our judgment on stuff that we're listening to, seeing, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, this podcast is not sponsored. We're not affiliated with anyone. Nope. It genuinely is our own opinions and views. And we kind of say
it doesn't make any money, you know,
what we want. Yeah, exactly. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, you have things like Anderton's, which is a commercial enterprise there to sell you the products that they're showcasing. So, and I think it's down to you, to viewers, to also bear that in mind and not just see everything on face value. But as you say, the advertising standards have got involved in this instance and said, actually, yeah, you did blur the lines there, and there is some things you do need to follow. Even though you are a commercial enterprise and people should know you're there to make money, you're not being clear enough in what you're advertising. So interesting one. Anyway, enough about Anderton's.
Let's put the tin lid on that one and move on. And I think let's wrap it up for this week, because that's been a fantastic catch up, brilliant conversation. And just remember, if you're listening, tell us what you do to wind down from a gig at a weekend or whenever. Do you like to drive cross country listening to podcasts like I do? Or do you prefer to get home and have a cup of tea and a cheese sandwich like Kieran prefers? You know, which one is it? Let's do a vote. Or tell,
I think there's got to be some more exciting ones in there as well. Yeah, bonus points and a shout out on the podcast to the person that genuinely and honestly gives us the most interesting
absolutely
gig come down routine.
Brilliant. I'm looking forward to that one. Right, mate. Have a cracking weekend.
And you.
It's been a good week, and I'll speak to you next time.
It's been a pleasure, buddy.
It really has.
Speak to you soon.
All the best, mate. Ta-da. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, then why not give the rest of our shows a good listen too? And if you love our podcast or are a regular listener who wants to support the show even more, then consider buying us a coffee over on our Buy Me a Coffee page. Anyway, best wishes, and see you next time on the Guitar Smarts podcast.